we provided them guidance.
Morning. This is the, what day is it? February 3rd. February, I've lost track already. February 3rd, 2016, is the Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. And Elva, why don't you give us a few words first?
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, I just wanted to remind the committee of a couple things. As you know, we are in a short session. We don't have a lot of meetings scheduled because of the shortness of the month of February. We should have about 7 to 8 meetings. We will have a variety of items, several reports and follow-up from budget notes and some informational items that will either help inform decisions made this session or work that's going to be happening in the interim. If you can't make the meeting, please try and let Elephone know so we'll know if we have a quorum or not. And as a reminder, for quorum, we need 3 House members and 2 Senate members. As usual, materials for the meetings will be loaded at least 24 hours, if not more in advance of an OLIS for your review. You'll have daily agendas before you in hard copy. Unlike the long session, when you actually get budget bills before you from agencies, any budget adjustments for this session will be incorporated in omnibus bills collectively for all the agencies. So you won't see budget bills come through, but you may see some budget-related items that come before you during the short session. I wanted to kind of clarify that change in process between long and short sessions. That's all I have.
Thank you. So long-term, short-term, I guess short-term is the day, long-term is 3 or 4 weeks, which is pretty short-term, but just really quickly, a few comments. One, we have a major problem still in DHS, and there is a discussion whether we try to deal with some of that now as far as the budget issue is concerned. Others may feel differently than I do. I'm sure they do. I want to make some changes starting as soon as we possibly can. We've got a report coming in to look at, and I'll get that all of you as soon as that report comes in. We're thinking about setting up an evening meeting of the committee for those who could attend, probably on a Wednesday night, maybe a Tuesday night, kind of depends what everybody's schedule looks like. And you don't have to attend, but that way, if we announce it and set it up, we don't have to worry about quorum issues, and there'd be people from other areas of the legislature joining us if we do that. The issues that we have in DHS are incredibly complex. That is not a sustainable budget. The co-chairs can cover it in the short run, but potentially in 17 and 19, they're going to have a real problem if we don't do something. This is the most vulnerable population of people in Oregon. We want to make sure they're protected with proper services, but not to the point that we end up in 17 and 19 slashing services to them inappropriately in sort of a last-minute ditch-to-save program. So we want to be thoughtful about this. So. Now, that said, there will be some interesting, it appears there will be some interesting bills coming to us from other committees, from policy committees, which will require some time and effort on our part, too. So just be aware of that. As soon as we know something about those issues, we'll bring them to you, probably mainly about CCLs or maybe others I don't know about. So all that said, this morning we have a work session, which I'm going to ask that we do very quickly because we could easily lose our quorum. We have members that have to go testify in other bills. I think that's going to be kind of a theme for this whole session because people have bills that have to be read, seen, discussed in other committees, and that means they have to leave this committee to do it. So I'm going to ask you to make it short and sweet here. And I didn't bring the chicken today, but I can, for those of you who remember. And so I will go find the chicken if I need to. Eric, do you have it with you?
Got to jump with me.
Eric knows where it is. Okay. So
excellent.
So I would like to open a work session to our Human Service Oregon Health Authority report on the Real D project. I have a hard time not making fun of that because it's, you know, kind of a word you can play with, but, you know. So how about leading us off and introduce yourself to the committee and give us a synopsis of what's going on here.
Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Miller. I'm here today as the DHS Chief Operating Officer for Technology. As panelists, we'll introduce ourselves. We only have 3 slides. We'll be quick.
Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, my name is members of the committee. My name is Leanne Johnson, for the record, and I am the Division Director for the Oregon Health Authority Office of Equity and Inclusion.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Lydia Muñiz, and I am the Director of the Office of Equity and Multicultural Services for the Department of Human Services.
We're here this morning to update you on the RealD initiative. RealD is an initiative that you created when you passed what became ORS 413-161. When you passed that law, it was aspirational in nature. You asked the two departments to work together to find ways to gather better race, ethnicity, language, and disability data about the clients that we serve so that that information could be used by our provider organizations, CCOs, on the health authority side to address healthcare disparities for particular vulnerable populations, and on the DHS side to address service equity issues. So in August of 2014 to June of 2015, we did an assessment of all of our current data systems that are have client information in them. We built a strategy that was created as part of a POP that frankly was built on the Oracle platform. You're all very clear about our relationship with Oracle, and so in the middle of the last session, I came to the table and said, in fact, I think that strategy needs to be abandoned. We need to change the approach to how we deal with this information altogether. And so mid-session, long session, we proposed to you an alternative that would take a data warehouse that already exists in our shared service organization called Office of Forecasting and Research Analysis, and it would take information that we could gather as part of the one eligibility system, because we will service eventually a million Oregonians in that eligibility system, and we could take the information from the one system, put it in our data warehouse, and connect it to data that we have about clients that both agencies serve. So in the 2015 session, you told us that approach was okay, and you asked us to come back and report in the interim about the progress that we made. So from June to December of this year, there were five positions total authorized, and we have collectively hired those positions. So each organization has a policy analyst whose job it is to make sure that the data that we're gathering in the technology system is compliant with policy, that we understand what that information actually tells us. We understand when we have enough data that we can actually draw conclusions and share it intelligently with people. The folks in our Office of Research and Analysis hired a project coordinator, a program person, whose job it is to really understand the structure of the data and the work that is necessary to support what these folks are going to do with it from a policy perspective. And then our Office of Information Services is in the process, or has hired a IT person whose job it is to actually do the code work to get the data from the one system into the database. So that's where we were.
And this is where we are now. And Ms. Miller has really explained very clearly the integration between the various departments within the Oregon Health Authority and DHS that are working together to move forward the REAL Plus D program. So you can see that there is an integration between technology and program, which is critical in this work, because we have at this point in time in Office of Equity and Inclusion and in the Office of OEMS, pardon me, we have our programmatic people, the people that are working on the reason why this is important and focusing on the client pieces, the human pieces of this, and then we have our technologists that are following our lead to make sure that we have the technology to support the work that we are moving forward to better serve the people of the state of Oregon.
And the final slide that we have is the work plan that we have put together for you to take a look at it. And as you can see, for phase one, as has been explained, we are currently in the process of really just assembling the team. There are a couple of, I think, positions that are just about ready to come on board. Part of that will be the work of the analysts will be to identify the work moving forward, some of the training needs, organizing the committee that will help us from the stakeholder perspective inform the conversation and some of the work that will be done related to REAL D. Phase two is really about the ICS expansion and taking a look at that to see what the needs are, what we will need to have OFRA staff redesign so that it accepts some of the information and the disaggregated information that we'll start gathering with REAL D. We anticipate that that would run through about June 2016 or thereabouts in terms of looking at what data needs to be redesigned to fit the need of this legislation and this work. For reports and analysis, Under the statute that this legislation put in place, we do report out to you every even legislative year, so you will be getting another update in June 2016 of where we are with everything and any adjustments that we've done or added in terms of the work plan. And then there is one of the major pieces of this work is our community engagement and really going out to a lot of our community partners and folks that have been working on this work for a very long time. And again, re-engaging with them, keeping them informed and gathering feedback in terms of how the work proceeds. And then finally, as a phase five, we have on the work plan that will be a consistent, analysis, reviewing the work, any readjustments that need to be made, keeping you informed. Ultimately, this work is going to help inform the work that you do as well as the work of the agencies to be able to determine policy or, any focus in communities or services that may be needed. So that's sort of our plan for right now, and we will keep you updated on any updates.
I think just in terms of closing comments, and then we're happy to take any questions you might have, it's important that the committee understand that neither department is treating this as a technology project anymore. We told you when we were in front of you in the 2015 session that, in fact, the technology component of this is very small and should really be considered a maintenance and operations enhancement to the data warehouse that's in our forecasting unit. What's really important about this work is all of the policy-related work and the equity-related work that will happen as a result of the data. And so we're certainly happy to come back and have a policy conversation at any time, but this effort will not be reported in the traditional way that we report major IT initiatives in either agency. Happy to take any questions the committee might
questions?
Have.
Questions?
I have four questions. Hopefully they'll be really quick. If you can stop me after any of them.
We have a member that needs to go testify, so go ahead.
Okay, so I have a policy question, an admin question, and an IT, two IT questions. Policy-wise, one of the reasons that I think this was the health equity data collection mm-hmm. bill, right? One of the things that we wanted to do was not just ensure that we share the data, which is really important, and thank you for the important work you do, to CCOs, to all the groups that need this data, but also to make sure that we disaggregate the data. Because, for instance, Asian and Pacific Islanders, if you have a Samoan population, a Chinese population, they're thrown in, and you're trying to collect data on teen smoking, teen birth, cancer rates, things like that, they're obviously their physical makeup as well as their cultural makeup is very different. And so how much progress are you making on actually on your forms disaggregating that so we can be more strategic in our response to emerging problems?
Co-Chair Bates, Representative Kenny Geyer, I'll answer, and then if my policy colleagues want to tack on anything, they can. The department had an advisory committee that promulgated administrative rule that actually disaggregates race and ethnicity language from the standard census categories into, what's the number? It's like north of 50
yes.
different
yeah.
subcategories so that we can track very specifically, characteristics that will help us provide culturally competent care, culturally competent access to services. And so as part of the modifications we made in the one eligibility system, we actually use the entire set of race and ethnicity codes that are policy compliant. That will be the first IT system in any of the either department's systems that will gather that information. Now, lucky for us, it happens to have the biggest exposure, so we'll gather it for lots of people. But the committee needs to understand it's not required. We don't force a choice, so a person has to self-identify.
Right.
And so we actually expect that there'll be some people who come and use the system and don't choose to self-identify. We continue to make policy enhancements, though, that help us have conversations about why it's important to share that information with the clients who we're interacting with. So I expect that self-reporting will grow over time as it's comfortable for folks, as they find a choice on a form or in our online application that they can actually identify with. I would expect that number to increase. And so we've done the policy work to identify the disaggregation. We're just starting to incorporate it into places where we actually have a mechanism to capture the response.
Thank you very much. That's fantastic. I worked on that bill, and it's really great to see the progress since then. Two IT questions. One is, I've heard that the CCOs are actually losing their race data, and I'm also aware that the public health data system is different than this. So could you respond to both of those quickly, please?
Co-Chair Bates, Representative Kenny Geyer. So we need to be really clear about what the CCO experience is, and I'd be happy to talk to any CCO who has a specific question. When we did the one eligibility system, we made agreement with the CCO not to change the interface between Oregon's MMIS, the Medicaid system, and the CCO systems as part of our initial implementation. And currently, the 834 transaction, which is how we communicate with CCOs to send enrollment data, only allows 7 census-related codes. And so because we aren't making any change in that 834 as part of the 1215 go-live, they don't have benefit for this additional information. We are right now working with the CCO Technical Advisory Group to schedule that implementation for the code changes. And so what will happen is, mechanically, we're going to tack on at the end of the 834 transaction an optional segment that will provide all this data. CCOs, for the most part, are going to have to make changes in their IT systems to actually receive the data and do something with it. And so I think their ability to use the information that we give to them will be dependent on both sides of that equation making the modifications. So it's the intention of the Oregon Health Authority to make that available once CCOs consult that they're ready to start testing in spring of 2016. And so I don't have reference for their losing their data. We just haven't given them it at the disaggregated level because we made a commitment not to change the enrollment transaction as part of initial go-live.
Okay, thank you.
And the public second health. Question about public health database, I actually have to take that one back. I'm not experienced enough to answer that question.
Thank you. And then my last one is on the administrative level. I thought that we used to have 9 positions. This is really, really important work to really help us determine how we have effective strategy on how we're going to meet birth weight, a whole variety of different goals. And I thought we had 9, and now it's 5. Can you tell me whether it's growing, shrinking? We also have all these federal mandates that we have to deal with. Where are we at this stage?
Co-Chair Bates, Representative Kenny Geyer, both agencies have positions, and both agencies use different strategies in those initial positions. So it's my understanding that to get to 9, there were a number of limited duration positions that were created, and some of those positions have not been converted to permanent. So I'll let both directors speak to how many actual positions they have in their organization. But I think that at the agency head level, both agencies remain very committed. These executives both report directly to their agency directors. They sit on executive teams as important components of the work and conversation we're having all day, every day about how to advance these objectives in the mission of the agency. Can you each tell how many positions you have?
Lydia Muniz with DHS. So in the Office of Equity and Multicultural Services, we have a total of 8 staff, but they are not all specific to Real D. We have it divided into service equity. We have a civil rights component. We have a diversity and inclusion component. The Real D position added an additional position for us, and so that makes it 9, and that one is specific to the policy work of Real D.
And Leon Johnson, Office of Equity and Inclusion. In our office, we have currently 19 positions, and we are looking to 23 as a proposal in the true-up of this rebalance time. We have half of our staff working in the area of health equity, very specifically language access, regional health equity coalitions, and a variety of other areas where they're out and about in the health system working to integrate health equity strategies into the work of the coordinated care organizations, into the public health system across the state of Oregon. And then we have our internal focus of diversity and inclusion work, recruitment and retention of a diverse workforce, also the maintenance of non-discrimination for the public and non-discrimination for our employees. So that is our primary base of work, health equity and on one side, and diversity and inclusion for the Oregon Health Authority on the other side. Within that, we have the position of an OPA-4 that will be dedicated to this Real D work.
Any other questions?
I'll just make a statement that I think it's really important work. I wasn't clear in those responses whether you actually have shrunk. It sounds like you did because you didn't convert LD positions, but I think the work is incredibly important if we're going to be serious about closing gaps. So thank you for your work. Mm-hmm. I'll continue to ask questions about this every time.
Great. Happy to have them.
Other questions? Seeing none. Just a quick comment. Nice job of going after a database and we're available, not starting a whole new program. Nicely played.
Yep.
Hope you can pull it off. The real question here is, do we get good data that we can actually close the issues we have to deal with as far as racial inequality and other issues in health care? So I appreciate the work you're doing. That said, I would take a motion, please.
Or I can make a
I'm sorry, you have to make a recommendation first. Just trying to get somebody.
The Legislative Fiscal Office recommends acknowledging receipt of the report.
Okay, thank you. I'm
Mr.
Sorry.
Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to make a motion that we acknowledge receipt of the report.
We have motion to acknowledge the report on the Real D effort. Any discussion? Any questions? Any objections? Seeing none, as we acknowledge receipt of the report, we'll take it in full. And I think we have to get it full,
yes,
don't we? And so we'll need a carrier for it. Who is on full here? Besides me.
Nathanson and me.
We're done with three. Okay, I don't know if we're meeting Friday.
Friday, yeah.
Is it going to be there Friday?
Not this Friday.
Okay, yeah, I'll take it if nobody else wants it. That's okay. Fine. I'll be glad to take it. Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Close the work session. You're out of here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your work, okay? I'd like to hear more about the real one.
I think I'm seeing you shortly.
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair, while the H is coming up, folks are coming up. So the next two items are informational updates on a couple of projects, IT projects that have been funded in the last and current biennium at efforts by both the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority. This first project the materials before you today say centralized abuse management. I wanted to point out that when this was actually before and approved, this project had a different name. It was called the Statewide Adult Abuse and Report Writing System. It was quite a mouthful. It's a little shorter now, but if you see references to that project, it is the same project. It's just been renamed as the project's been developed.
Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Miller. I'm still the DHS COO for technology.
Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Marie Cervantes. I'm the director of the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigations, otherwise known as OAPI.
Good morning, committee. Chair Bates, Chair Nathanson, for the record, my name is Tamara Brickman. I'm with the Chief Financial Office of DAS.
Okay, I'm going to provide just a little bit of background, and then Sarah's going to talk to you about Phase 1, Phase 1A, and Phase 2. For background purposes, OAPI was created in March of 2012. We are a shared services program that we provide abuse investigation services to various DHS programs and Oregon Health Authority programs. In terms of context of numbers of investigations, in 2014, we received over 38,000 calls of abuse, and we investigated more than 18,000 of those. Screenings and investigations are currently documented and gathered in different systems across the state. They can be in different homegrown systems within a local community, on paper and pen in local field offices, spreadsheets, et cetera. One of the most significant risks of the current system is a lack of an intake and screening system, resulting in an inability to view cases that are closed at screening. In our business plan, which I believe that you have all received, and it was part of our updates previously to the committee, we documented numerous barriers, limitations, and inefficiencies. For example, an inefficient and difficult oversight of investigations in process and screening decisions by local offices, no standardized or centralized means of documenting screenings, protective services, or investigation reports. There is an inability to collect and report meaningful data, identify trends, and target prevention efforts. So for those of you who have read our annual report or seen our financial exploitation study, those are all literally done by hand. The staff read the reports, they pull the data, they put them into spreadsheets, and they create a report for you to understand what's going on with abuse in Oregon. There is a limited ability to perform quality assurance data or give our field access to their own data so that they can solve their own problems. There's extensive manual data mining and exposure to litigation, and one of the important things that we also cannot do is link perpetrators across systems or link victims across systems. So to sum it up, the absence of a statewide abuse reporting system and data repository makes it difficult or impossible to monitor abuse-related events centrally and correlate these incidents across the state. This inability to connect the dots across regions and programs creates risk to vulnerable adults. So that's a very quick overview. I think most of the problems are stated up there on the slide, and now Sarah's going to talk to you about phase 1, 1A, and 2.
So in the 2014 session, we started phase 1 at your request. You asked the department to enter into planning work to create a business case. You actually directed the department through budget note to use a third party to do that work, and the results of that work were being made available in the long session last year. When I came to the agency, I looked at my job as COO for technology is to sit squarely between program and technology and make sure that the solutions and strategies the department puts forward in technology projects make sense. I had fundamental questions about the conclusion that was being drawn by the vendor who did the business case, and in raising those questions to DHS leadership, I think created enough conversation where we adjusted our strategy. And you all granted special purpose appropriation to protect resources to fund this project, and that contractor at the time recommended a custom built solution. We told you in the long session that we wanted to do additional planning work, that it was the opinion of the new CIO and myself that a custom-build solution for this work did not make sense, that we believe there had to be solutions out there that existed, and we wanted to take a look at those as an alternative strategy. So you gave us permission to do some additional research and analysis, and so for the last 7 months, we've had an internal project team who actually looked at 14 different states' solutions and the local solution in Lane County. They conducted 4 site visits. And I'm a strong believer if you're going to talk about a system transfer project, you should not just believe what the sales guys have to say. You should take people who do the work to sit with people using the system in the place that are doing the work, and you should let those people talk to each other about whether the system can be used to do the work or not. So we sent folks to 4 different places, L.A. County, which actually uses Harmony as a COTS solution product, to the state of Colorado, which uses a Salesforce platform, to Lane Council of Governments, which uses a custom application that they built. And then, you know, it occurred to us, right, we do child welfare reporting in the SACWA solution, and so we looked at ORCIDs and the viability of making adjustments to ORCIDs. So it's the opinion of that project team as a result of all that analysis and those site visits that, in fact, there are what I would call commercially viable solutions available in the marketplace. And so it's the intention of the department to release a request for proposal that would invite a transfer system to meet Oregon's business needs. In order to make a transfer system work, right, we have to have really tough conversations about you use the technology as it's built and deployed successfully in a location, and you make the fewest changes possible to that technology. So for this RFP process to result in a good product for Oregon, we'll have to be really clear about what our needs are so that we can assess that functionality against our needs. But we may have to have conversations about changing our actual processes in order to utilize the technology as designed. We are keeping in close consultation with both your professional staff, Mr. Cummings, and with the Office of the State CIO, and this is a major IT project, contrary to the one I was just talking about before, and so we regularly report on this. We're going through the stage gate process to make sure that we have appropriate project management methodologies in place. And so we propose to move forward with an RFP to procure a centralized abuse management solution. Happy to take any questions from the committee.
Questions? Will this system help us prevent the kind of abuse that's gone on in the children's programs and our unknown and concern about people in foster homes, in ELF facilities, and people just in general public who might be especially financially abused, but the elderly people and other types of abuse too. How well are these systems tracking in other states? What's the net result on the ground?
Co-Chair Bates, members of the committee, certainly a centralized abuse management system that provides a single place where abuse reporting can be logged, where We can look across local delivery offices for trends. We can look across programmatic offices to make sure that, we're appropriate. It's going to improve the situation. Will it prevent it? No. Do we think that it will give us better tools and techniques to identify how we can adjust our services? Yes. Will vulnerable Oregonians be more protected as a result of having a single location and a repository for this information? Yes. It actually was created with special focus on adult abuse reporting, right? I'll remind you that the name of the old project was Statewide Adult Abuse Reporting. OAPI does service some children's related populations, and so that's partially why we changed it to centralized abuse management, is to take out adult. But its initial deployment in terms of the direct sort of foster care reporting is not in scope initially.
And when would you think you might have the project completed after functioning?
So, Co-Chair Bates, members of the committee, I could tell you that answer, but until I have permission to put an RFP on the street, it would be totally made up.
Okay. Well, we've heard that before, too, so I appreciate your honesty. We'll expect further reports when you know more.
Happy to. Thank you so much.
Any other questions? Thanks for your report. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Susan Lauder next.
Yeah.
Now, the Oregon Health Authority and
Susan Otter,
I believe, is going to come up next. Ms. Otter.
Switch. Sure. I don't care.
Changing of the guard. We're going to get you out of here early today with any kind of luck, okay? I know you hate that, but you got to get to the floor and read those bills. Good morning.
Good morning.
You want to start this up for
Chair,
us?
I will, Chair, and members of the subcommittee. This is an update on the health information technology various projects. Susan's here to tell us a little bit about kind of the broad view of their program and what else going on, but also three specific projects: common credentialing, provider directory, and something about, and metric, collection of metrics. And it's really just an update. She was here during the long session. Because there's a lot going on, it seemed like it was worth another update.
Great.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Introduce yourself again to the committee, please.
Sure. Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Susan Otter, and I'm the Director of Health Information Technology for the Oregon Health Authority. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. Good morning, Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. I'm Tom McDonald with the Chief Financial Office.
Great. So as Linda mentioned, I'm here to update you on some of the health IT efforts we have in the Oregon Health Authority. First, I'd like to talk about, a little context setting for health information technology, the opportunities and challenges. So when we talk about health information technology, we're talking about electronic health records, tools that help share and exchange patient information and allow for care coordination, analytics tools that allow the efficient use of aggregated data to look at quality and outcomes, patient tools that allow for patients to interact electronically with their own health records, and telehealth as well. Our new coordinated care model relies on a base infrastructure of health information technology and information sharing to be the most effective it can be. And we're seeing investments in health information technology abound in Oregon. We've always been a high adoption state for electronic health records, and we still are finding some challenges. Our providers are reporting challenges in maximizing the efficiencies of their electronic health records. We have health information exchange efforts advancing in several regions where communities have come together to partner around sharing information electronically. And we find that our CCOs are all investing in health information technology tools, community health information exchange, care coordination, and analytics tools to support their coordinated care model efforts. Connecting all members of the care team is critical for the coordinated care model. I'm going to talk a little bit today about one effort to share hospital information across the care team, which is founded in the Emergency Department Information Exchange, and give you an update on some of the exciting work that we're doing there. We're also finding challenges in what we call the digital divide. So providers like behavioral health providers that aren't able to participate fully in federal incentive payments for adopting electronic health records. And so we're finding there's a lot of electronic health record adoption on the physical health side, but less consistency for behavioral health providers and certainly some challenges and barriers for long-term care providers and others. I'd like to update you today as well on the award we received from the federal grant that we're passing through to Jefferson Health Information Exchange that is focusing on behavioral health information sharing barriers. And then lastly, we're investing in health information technology. Linda mentioned three projects that I'd like to update you on today, the Common Credentialing Project and two others that we're implementing to support our CCOs and healthcare stakeholders in their efforts. So the first piece I wanted to talk with you about today is one of the most exciting things in health information technology in Oregon. The Emergency Department Information Exchange allows for the sharing of hospital event data across all Oregon hospitals and includes information from all Washington hospitals as well. This information is brought to us through a collaborative public-private partnership with between OHA, the Health Leadership Council, and other partners, including the Hospital Association, the College of Emergency Room Physicians, our commercial health plans, and CCOs, and other stakeholders. The Emergency Department Information Exchange, or EDI, brings the hospital event information that's collected real-time from hospital emergency departments and inpatient systems and brings that information back to the emergency departments when they have a high utilizer of emergency department services. So when someone comes into an emergency department, their electronic health record checks the EDI system to see if that person has been rotating through emergency departments, and if so, returns a very simple summary of that person's history of hospitalizations and emergency department usage, known care providers, and other key information that's been entered, such as pain contracts or other notes about that patient that's relevant for the ED doc. Pre-manage is the second phase, and that brings the EDI information back to the care team. So the CCOs, health plans, and care providers can access information from the EDI system about their own, for their own patients and members. It gives them the opportunity to get real-time notifications when their high-risk members are in the emergency department or have had a hospital event. Pre-manage is also allows for the care coordinators, primary care, et cetera, to look at a dashboard for their patient populations, manage to cohorts, so group their patients by particular characteristics, and identify folks that need intervention and follow-up. Also, pre-manage.
We have a question. Yeah, if you want to ask questions, we go along, also okay. And I was to make a comment. This may sound really boring.
No, it doesn't.
It's not
but,
boring.
No,
it's fantastic.
But,
I would,
but for those of us who are in the system, and I'm not going to speak for Senator Steiner-Hayward, but it is the EDI system actually works. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's amazing. That you actually have a program that works. My ER doctors absolutely love it. And it really leads to much better patient care. So when you hear about all the systems that fail and all the bad things that happen, this one is working great. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to celebrate our victories because we're too often we don't appreciate them. So we're going to go to the House side first, and Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. I want to hear just a bit more about pre-manage. It sounds great, but can you give me just a little bit more detail? So that means if someone is at Hospital A mm-hmm. over here and they've gotten information that this person has been in Hospital B in the past, does it take some sort of proactive step while someone is caring for someone in an emergency department? Do they have to remember to send a message to a CCO, or is this something automatically happening? Mm-hmm. That's the first question. Is it just going to automatically happen mm-hmm. And not take time or thinking away from someone? And then at the other end, is there like an automated alert? Does something pop up on people's screens? Does someone get a text message so that it's right in their face that something happening right then? Or is this mainly for later that they know someone was in the hospital earlier today?
Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, it is an automated system. So when the person is having a hospital visit, the information about that hospital visit is automatically uploaded into the EDI database and is made available to any user who has subscribed for that patient. So there's two different cases. One is for an emergency department user, in which case they are automatically given a summary for any individual that comes into the ED that has a high utilizer of ED services. On the pre-managed side, you would see a primary care provider, a CCO, or their health plan, maybe their behavioral health provider will have subscribed for that particular patient that they are responsible for. And they can set the system up to receive it automatically in the way that they choose. So they can set it up to receive an automatic notification. That could be a flag in their email to go check the system. It could be a flag within the system saying these are your notifications. It could be a summary that they get. What we're finding is mostly folks in the primary care setting and in the CCOs are using the data dashboard to manage their populations and are less often setting up that notification feature. Because they end up getting notified, kind of bombarded with notifications, yeah. And what they really want is the concise, digested, meaningful information about the populations they're concerned about. So, for example, a CCO might set up a cohort, several cohorts of their members, and say, here's our full member list. We want to know when there's a pediatric patient admitted for an asthma event into the hospital or into the ED. And we want that information for that cohort to go to this particular case manager within the CCO. And then that case manager can either get real-time alerts, as I mentioned, or they can be monitoring their dashboard and drill into that information.
Got it. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. I'm debating whether to say a few things. I think I'll keep my peace here.
Okay.
There are still flaws in the system, but they're working towards fixing them. I mean, I commonly get information about when the janitor cleaned the room and what nurse was in and out, when the vitals were taken, when I want the discharge summary. Okay, so I mean, you just have to pick through. But they're getting better all the time on it. Mm. So, questions? Let's go down the line. Representative Boone, do you have a question?
No, I have a comment. So, Representative Boone. And I think you answered it, Susan, but that's kind of what I was thinking too is it, at first I was thinking, well, if patient A comes into the emergency department on a regular basis, or even not on a regular basis, but say they do, they've seen them three or four times, I thought, okay, those people who are on duty that time who have seen that person before might remember that. But how does that work? Does it come into their system and when they enter the name, say, bing, you know, this person's a frequent flyer, and then it takes them to their chart or whatever?
Mm-hmm. Co-Chair Bates, Representative Boone. So the emergency department has a number of options in how they configure the receipt of that high utilizer report. We have about half of our emergency departments in Oregon have integrated the alert into their electronic health record. So when they look at the electronic health record for that patient, there'll be a tab that's kind of a flashing tab that says there's an EDI alert here, and they can click on that and pull up the alert.
Okay.
The other folks can have set it up to a secure fax or a secure printer, so they have more of a paper-based workflow in their emergency department, and they receive the information off the secure fax. It gets slapped on the patient's chart and then handed to the provider.
So, and just a quick follow-up. So if they go to a different hospital, same thing, then they put that person's name in and it comes up with a flag or a tab on it?
Yeah, so Co-Chair Bates, Representative Boone, so you might have Hospital A has set it up to be integrated into the EHR. Hospital B has set it up to a secure fax or printer.
Okay.
And so it's just really up to that hospital how they receive the information.
And if they don't, follow up. If they have to subscribe to it to be integrated into the system, what if Hospital B says, we're going to do it on our own, we don't care about this?
Co-Chair Bates, Representative Boone, so all Oregon hospitals have committed to participating in the program for the 3 years. So the program is, the utility is set up as a three-year demonstration project through the end of 2017. At that time, the governing body will make a recommendation as to whether to continue it. The idea was that we don't know how technology might evolve or whether our electronic health records and it might solve this problem for us in 3 years, but we've had such incredible positive feedback. I mean, it's very unusual to have a health information technology rollout that has such...
There will be a revolt in emergency room departments if this program is dropped. I can guarantee it.
Oh, yeah. No.
Okay?
You would,
this
you would
is
not, be
this is
going it.
To be staying. It's a great program. It's doing exactly what you're asking of it. Do I have another follow-up?
Do you have another follow-up, Tim?
Guess not.
Oh, no. Sorry.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to add my congratulations on this because we passed a bill in the legislature last year to improve hospital discharge policies around mental health crises in acute care settings. And that group of hospitals, mental health providers, mental health consumers and advocates have been working on that and commenting on how the parallel development of this system is aligning really beautifully. And so thank you for all your work on it. I'm enormously excited about this.
Representative Stark.
Thank you, Co-Chair Bates. I have two questions, but I'll take one at a time if that's all right. The first one on the high user notification. Mm-hmm. Can you give just kind of, for those of us that don't spend a lot of time in the ER, a real life scenario of, so a physician, an ER doc, gets this notification, hey, this guy's been in and out all over the place. How would that actually change his response to working with that person?
Co-Chair Bates, Representative Stark. So we have one real-life example I can think of where we have an individual who's a member of the CCO who has been a high utilizer of ED services and had at the height 23 ED visits in 1 month. And so the emergency department physician, in receiving the EDI alert, an EDI alert is typically sent to the emergency department if the person has had 5 or more visits in 12 months, or 3 different emergency departments in the last 60 days. The hospital can tighten that or change those parameters, but those are the baseline parameters that are automatically set. So the emergency department physician would get the alert and would include the list of where the person has been seen, at what time, and for what key problem. Would also include the known care providers and any notes that folks have entered into the system that the ED doc might need to know. And so what we've heard is that ED docs use the notes as well as the history to have a frank conversation with the individual and say things like, you know, I see you were at this hospital just last week and this hospital before then. What was, you know, you've had the same issue. What's really going on? Can you tell me about this? They'll also include notes between the users of the system that the ED doc can see about pain contracts for folks that are seeking opiate prescriptions. And so they are able to pretty quickly cut to the chase, is what we've heard. We've heard from ED providers that the reaction they get from patients is, oh, now I see you're all talking to each other. You're all telling me the same thing when I go to the ED. The other thing that will happen then is the ED may follow up with the primary care provider if they're listed as one of the known providers and make sure that they're aware of what's going on. On the flip side, we have, for this particular individual, our CCO had been tracking this person and not able to track them down because this was someone that was homeless, and they weren't able to follow up with them and find them. And so they set up their pre-managed subscription to alert them real time when anyone like that they've been having a hard time finding, showed up in the emergency department. The care coordinator got in their car and drove to the emergency department and met with that person and was able to help counsel them to get them into primary care and to help them manage their chronic conditions. And so that person has been, still have some emergency department visits, but their highest month has been 3 visits instead of 23, and they're continuing to work with them.
Second question.
Thank you, Chair. So that actually leads into my next question, which has to do with the pre-manage. And I'm not as, again, well versus my colleagues here when it comes to client confidentiality laws. Mm-hmm. Is there an option for a client or a patient to opt out of that information being shared? I'm maybe that individual didn't want the CCO to show up or doesn't want their, I understand the idea of coordinated care, but for some reason they don't want their family physician getting a notice. Is there the ability for them to opt out of this, and how's that work with those laws?
Co-Chair Bates, Representative Stark. So a patient can opt out at the hospital for the information to be shared with the care team, and the system can monitor and track that. Some of our subscribers to pre-manage have opted to implement an opt-in model and have required, requested patients or their members to approve the use of this tool mm-hmm. for their care, and others have not. So folks can choose to opt out within their CCO or their primary care provider, but we're not finding that that's been the case.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And just to put an edge to it, if you sign up with most primary care physicians, and along with what you sign your mortgage you don't read, there's places you're signing and saying, we get the information on you for various means, so it's open that way. Mm-hmm. It's for your own good. It's not, it's obviously not to be used the edge to.
I'm glad.
I do have one quick comment, Mr. Chair, if I may. Thank you. And this is really truly a comment. One of the only things that really is lacking clearly right now from Edie is the ability to link internally with the Oregon Prescription Drug Monitoring Database, which has been an incredibly important tool in addressing our state's significant opiate addiction problem, and it's one of the reasons that people bounce around from emergency department to emergency department. Many electronic health records systems have that prescription drug monitoring database already integrated into the EHR itself so that you don't have to go into two separate systems. And I have to say, as much as I like PDMP, it's a pain in the neck, to use a polite word, to access. The interface is kind of clunky. But for the emergency departments where they are, as Ms. Otter said, still paper-based, or they have an EHR where it's too expensive or complicated to integrate PDMP into it, we think it's very important that be accessible easily through EDI. And Representative Bueller and I have a bill about that this session, I believe. So we're going to be working on that and trying to make sure that happens soon to help combat our rising opiate problem. And I just wanted to bring that to this committee's attention.
We had that discussion last session. You were working on that.
We were working on it. It turns out we need legislation to make that happen. So we're working on it, and we're working with Ms. Otter's team and others to try to figure out a solution to that problem.
Thank you. Please continue. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. So we've had great uptake of pre-manage by our CCOs. We have 10 CCOs that have committed to or have launched a pre-managed subscription for their CCO members. So this map just shows the CCOs that have either launched pre-managed, so 7 are live with pre-manage, or have committed to doing so. That also shows the blue dots are all of the hospitals in the state that are participating in EDI, which are all the hospitals. I think we've mentioned some of the impressive impacts that we've had already in terms of the users of EDI and pre-manage. And so I mentioned the thank you for the opportunity to tell my story about the individual who's had 23 visits in 1 month. A couple of our CCOs have set up and reconfigured their care manager roles to actually be able to jump in the car and drive to the emergency department. And they're finding that workflow works really well, and they're able to be really effective. And they've never had that sort of real-time information to be able to contact someone before. So we're also seeing some real success in reducing rehospitalizations with the engagement of primary care. One of our primary care clinics that is subscribed to pre-manage has seen significant reductions in their rehospitalizations with this tool and their other interventions. We're connecting assertive community treatment teams, which to pre-manage. Those are teams that are responsible for individuals with severe and persistent mental illness that are at risk for institutionalizations. These teams wrap around those individuals to ensure that they stay out of an institution, and connecting them to real-time information when their clients are in the hospital has been really critical. They're particularly excited about getting the physical health information from those ED and inpatient visits and being alerted to that. And then we're seeing some community coordinated efforts, particularly in Central Oregon, to bring folks who are using pre-managed to the table to have some alignment in terms of how they're approaching those high-risk populations they share in common. So with that, I was going to turn to our three health IT projects and then end with our federal grant.
Can we just pause for a second and talk about one of the issues I'm concerned about yet in pre-managed and others, and that is the withholding of information by hospital systems to primary care offices that aren't necessarily employed by them. Mm-hmm. It's a growing problem, and it's really a political problem. I'm not talking about information about cost. We're talking about discharge summaries, medications the patient was discharged on, those kind of information. It's a serious problem, and I thought at first it was an IT problem, but I'm hearing it's a political problem. Do you have any comment on this?
Coach Bates, with health information exchange becoming more prevalent and expected with the federal meaningful use incentive program, we're seeing that organizations have to change their approach to sharing information more freely. And in some communities, we're seeing that our healthcare organizations have taken off their sort of hats where the owning of the data is the power that they have. And they're coming together, like in Southern Oregon and Jefferson HIE. And in other organizations around the country, we see that folks are still, healthcare organizations are still reluctant to freely share information. And so we're seeing, federal hearings on data blocking, some of which are related to technology vendors, but much of which is not, is related to political or organizational practices.
I just want to make that clear to the committee. This could be a real issue for us if it starts being common. When a patient leaves the hospital, that information is needed by the primary care doctor or the outside doctor, because nowadays most patients are cared for by hospitals and other specialists inside the hospital. They come out, and giving that information to whoever's caring for them outside the hospital is really important. If hospital systems hold on to that information, and we're talking about basic stuff, the ones I just mentioned, it's going to be a really serious problem for us. And I was unaware of it until the last few weeks, because in our area, that's not happening. But it was more of ours getting our team ready to go and getting it done, and it's great. We get the information we need. Also note the federal government feels very strongly about this as far as Medicare is concerned. If a Medicare patient is discharged from the hospital, you see them in the first 4 or 5 days after discharge, you actually get an increased payment for doing that, because they want to keep people from going back in the hospital. They know the key to keep people out of the hospital on readmissions, for the most part, is a good follow-up once they leave the hospital. So the feds are very serious about it. And I don't know why whole hospitals are holding all that information. If those patients in Medicare are readmitted, they don't get paid. And I just don't understand the reasoning here, but I think it has to do with politics of trying to align clinics and physicians and imaging centers and everything else into their alignment, more than taking care of patients. I think it's really immoral, frankly. I'm really upset by it, because you're hurting patients here, and we're supposed to be helping them. So I'll leave it there, but I wanted to bring that to the attention of the committee, because we may be seeing more about it later.
Mr. Chair, I want to add something to that, because I have a personal experience with it. It's not related to Medicare or Medicaid, but there was a little incident that was taken care of here at the Salem Hospital a couple of years ago, and it was all resolved fine, but there needed to be follow-up by my primary care physician. Something needed to be looked into. So after I got home, there was no way that the hospital could or would share an imaging result. I had to drive to Salem and pick up a physical copy of this thing and take it back to my physician. I have the personal resources. I have a car. I could afford the gas and the time to come back up here. How many people can't afford that? That was just idiotic. I was incensed.
Did they make you return it too?
No.
It happened to us. We had to even return it.
No.
It was on loan.
It would have been even worse if it had been urgent.
Yeah.
Commonly, they are charging for that, even though you drive back and forth. And it really can derail your care when something was urgent to be taken care of right away. So it's a serious problem. And I was told by the person who kind of pioneered it in our area, he told me that this is really a political problem, not an IT problem. And I was just blown away by that. I assumed it was just different systems learning to talk to each other, but they aren't that difficult to do. And it's political. And we may have to find, we're going to pass legislation to stop that practice.
Yeah.
That may come down to, I hope it won't. But anyway, sorry to interrupt you there, but it's an issue I feel very serious about because of it's patient care.
Yeah.
It's patient care. Okay.
I'll tell you.
Was there another question down here? Please continue, Susan.
Sure.
I'm sorry, what'd you say?
So I wanted to update you on the Common Credentialing Program. Senate Bill 604 in 2013 required the Oregon Health Authority to establish the Common Credentialing Database and Program to streamline the administrative processes affiliated with credentialing practitioners. Senate Bill 594 in the last session allowed flexibility with the implementation date for the program and required OHA to establish the implementation date by rule and give at least 6 months notice to stakeholders who will be required to comply with the program. The credentialing program will serve all credentialed healthcare practitioners in the state. There's about 55,000 practitioners that we think will be required to report to the credentialing program, and all credentialing organizations such as hospitals, health plans, ambulatory surgical centers, CCOs, and IPAs. There's about 280 credentialing organizations we estimate in Oregon. Those credentialing organizations will be required to use the information in the credentialing solution as part of their credentialing practices. They will not be able to go to the practitioner directly to ask for information that's already held in the solution, for example. The credentialing solution will capture the credentialing information as well as the key primary source documentation and do primary source verification, which is a time-consuming process that has to be done for the credentialing process. The solution will not take the place of a credentialing decision. That will, of course, still be up to the credentialing organizations. But it streamlines the credentialing application process and primary source verification. Our current status, we released an RFI in 2014 to get an understanding of the environment for the credentialing technology solutions out there. There are about two dozen off-the-shelf products in the space, and we're confident that we can find a good solution for Oregon. We spent the last year or so working with our project approvals through the DAS, Office of the State CIO, and the Legislative Fiscal Office. I'm pleased to say that our project has been approved by both offices, and we meet regularly with both offices monthly to update them on our status. We've also passed our required quality assurance initial risk assessment and have our quality assurance vendor on board as required before we launch into this project. We've contracted with a system integrator, which is Harris Corporation. And the system integrator will be a single point of accountability for the success of implementation of our projects and will also be responsible for the procurement and overseeing the vendors as they work to implement the projects. The systems integrator, I'm pleased that we have executed that contract. They're on board. They'll be releasing an RFP in the next couple of months. And then we expect a vendor to be on board this summer with a program launch 6 to 12 months after the vendor comes on board, so we're looking at 2017 for the program launch. We've been engaging stakeholders. We have a common credentialing advisory group as required by law, and that group has been very engaged. They meet monthly or every other month, and despite the length of time we've taken to get here, they're a very engaged group. They don't show signs of flagging. They're very excited about this, and that's been great. We also have a technical advisory group of the users of the program that advise us as we go forward as well. We'll be updating the rules and establishing fees over the next year, and we're looking forward to bringing this program to Oregon.
Thank you. This may sound like it's really down the weeds, because it is, but this was brought to me by an IPO group down in Southern Oregon that really said, why are we all doing this in different places? The medical board does it, hospitals do it, and then your insurers do it, and you're doing it 20 or 30 different places as a provider. And so we wanted to be the first state to have a common credentialing area. People could draw that data out, save millions of dollars. We estimated $150 million in the savings when the probe first got set up. When we first heard about it up here, Senator Steinhardt was kind enough to join and work with us on this, and really, I really appreciate his help on it. It's very technical stuff, very, very sensitive stuff, because credentialing means what you get to do as far as your insurer is concerned, what your privileges are in a hospital, and it's very, very tricky, and I'm glad we've actually taken the time to get this rolling. When we first started, no other state had it, and I think other states are looking at it, from my understanding, and they may have leapfrogged ahead of us once they saw the concept out there. And then we had everybody and his brother wanting to get into it. Was this going to be for physicians? And then nurse practitioners and nurses and respiratory therapists and physical therapists all said, hey, why I do the same thing, why can't I do it too? And so now it's going from 5,000 practitioners to 57,000?
55,000.
50,000, whatever, okay. So I appreciate you taking your time doing it right, because if this gets screwed up, we'll never have another shot at it. So I appreciate, I know it's taken 4 or 5 years, I understand that, that's okay. Thank you. When it comes on board, please make it work right, okay? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Can I ask a question here?
Yeah.
Or make a comment, actually. And yes, please make it work, because other sectors are looking at this, engineering, for example, structural engineers, from the light of emergency preparedness and reassessing buildings that we might be able to get into sooner after a seismic event. Not to mention, we may be without some of our engineers, literally. And so we're working with Canada on it. We've got a really good program, if we can make it work, with British Columbia. And because we're going to need people to come in and help us assess our structural situation before allowing people back into their buildings, but before they're completely renovated, et cetera. So, and I think we're going to need help in the electrical sector, wastewater, et cetera, because things are going to be in very bad shape, and especially in medical field, too.
So. Canada.
Sorry?
Canada.
Yay.
Canadian, please.
Thank you.
In fact, you're running out of time all of a sudden. We're getting out early. We're not, so roll.
Yes. All right, so I wanted to update you briefly on two other projects. So the Common Credentialing Project is our top priority for the HIT projects we have in development. There are 3 total projects we have in development. The second is a statewide provider directory. This is also looking at launching in 2017. Currently, our healthcare entities maintain multiple provider directories and extensive efforts to keep them updated as the healthcare practitioners move around, change locations, start to work with multiple different clinics, et cetera. So the challenges that each organization faces in keeping the information updated could be greatly mitigated by making information available through a statewide provider directory. This would provide efficiencies for healthcare operations and health plan operations, so thinking about health plans having a source to validate their provider network directories, which providers are still operating at the clinic that the health plan contracts with, for example. It also provides efficiencies for care coordination and information sharing by providing information about specialists, for example, that you might want to refer to, health information exchange addresses to send clinical information for providers outside of your organization, and also for analytics purposes. So right now it's very difficult to attribute a provider to their clinic, to their group, to their et cetera, and to be able to roll up and roll down data effectively. And so this is something that is critical for quality improvement efforts, for our efforts at the state and our researchers to be able to effectively look at the data that we have. We expect the provider directory will support OHA and DHS programs, as well as healthcare providers and systems, CCOs and health plans, and others. And health, I should say, in our regional health information exchanges. We'll be leveraging the common credentialing efforts. That will provide a great source of data on the 55,000 practitioners that are credentialed in Oregon. So we'll be pulling a subset of the credentialing data that's appropriate for sharing in a provider directory into our provider directory and supplementing that with other information. The provider directory will not be consumer-facing. This is really meant to be for healthcare organizations and state agencies. Again, the status is that our projects have been approved by DAS, Office of State CIO, the LFO. We've received our initial quality assurance risk assessment approval, and we have considerable CMS funding at 90% federal match to invest in the development and implementation of this provider directory, with ongoing federal match expected for the Medicaid share. We do expect to charge fees for the sustainability of the provider directory for our non-Medicaid uses, and we'll be looking at fee development over the next year. Our system integrator will be releasing the RFP in mid-2016, and we expect this to be launched in 2017. And we're engaging stakeholders. We have a public provider directory advisory group that's been exceedingly interested in this. They asked for us to extend the length of their monthly meetings so that they could really dive into this, and folks are very excited.
Thank you.
And then our third project is the Clinical Quality Metrics Registry. This is a project that supports the Medicaid program in collecting three clinical quality metrics from that our CCOs are required to report. Currently, those metrics, which come from electronic health records, include optimal diabetes care, so looking at those A1C results, controlling hypertension, and depression screening and follow-up. The registry will capture those metrics electronically. They're currently being entered and sent to us through Excel spreadsheets right now. And that we can collect it in our registry directly from a provider's electronic health record, from the CCO, or from a third party, such as a health information exchange or other data aggregator. There are federal requirements for electronic health records that are certified to be able to report on these specific clinical quality metrics that are specified through the Meaningful Use Federal Incentive Program. The registry will allow for new insights into clinical outcomes and allow for efficiencies in aligned reporting. We expect to expand beyond the three CCO metrics to include the full set of 64 meaningful use metrics for providers and require reporting for the Medicaid EHR incentive program to come in through this registry. Ideally, we'd like the registry to serve as a one-stop reporting place for our providers and clinics for these specific metrics that can then be used to report out to multiple programs. But we're starting incrementally with the three CCO metrics. Our status is similar. We've passed our reviews. Our CMS funding has been approved, again, at 90% federal match. And our RFP will be released in mid-2016 with a launch in 2017. And we're engaging our stakeholders as well in the development of this project.
Questions?
Okay. And lastly, I came to this body in March of last year to ask for approval to apply for a federal grant. This is the Advanced Interoperable Health Information Technology Services to Support Health Information Exchange Grant, one of the longest titles of grants that I've been involved in. It's supported by offered by the Federal Office of the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology. And I'm pleased to report that we were one of 12 states awarded a grant out of about 30 some applicants. We received $1.6 million in federal funds for the two-year cooperative agreement. We have a single subrecipient, as we discussed with you last March, which is Jefferson Health Information Exchange. The focus of the Jefferson Health Information Exchange project is largely to focus on integrating behavioral health information and combining that with the physical health information. Their target populations include behavioral health, primary care, federally qualified health centers, and emergency providers and disability services. And there are a handful of projects that this grant will be funding. The first that I'd like to mention is the Common Consent Model for Behavioral Health Information Sharing. There are significant barriers we've found in providers and healthcare organizations understanding the federal and state requirements that restrict behavioral health information sharing, and multiple different interpretations of those requirements, including 42 CFR Part 2. So the first step in the common consent model for Jefferson Health Information Exchange is a universal interpretation of the law. And that's been completed, and then they'll be working on a common consent form that will be circulated and socialized in a statewide behavioral health information sharing summit this spring. With the sort of community buy-in to the common consent model, Jefferson Health Information Exchange will then make the form available, and we'll be happy to share that as a model for other organizations around the state. And then they'll implement that information, that form, and the information in it electronically into the Jefferson Health Information Exchange. That will allow primary care providers, for example, who have the right consents in place as authorized by law, to access the behavioral health information for their patients through their Jefferson Health Information Exchange services. So we're very excited about that. The other projects include bringing in new sources of data into Jefferson Health Information Exchange, including the Emergency Department Information Exchange data, critical access hospitals coming on board, and behavioral health, electronic health record integration into Jefferson Health Information Exchange, which will be very exciting. Jefferson Health Information Exchange is also working on eHealth Exchange certification, which is a federal program that allows connectivity to the VA and the Social Security Administration. So they'll be able to exchange data with those federal agencies with this funding. And then if the bill that Senator Steiner Hayward mentioned, House Bill 4124, related to the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, were to pass, this funding would allow for Jefferson HIE to connect to the PDMP data electronically as well. So there's funding in there in case that bill passes.
When the bill passes.
Thank you. Your comment? And I just wanted to show you, in terms of who Jefferson Health Information Exchange is, they're a nonprofit community-based organization that started in Southern Oregon. You can see that they have 7 hospitals and 4 health systems participating, 5 CCOs in the Southern Oregon and Columbia River Gorge areas, and more than 700 enrolled providers at more than 200 clinics. The dark green are the counties where they have enrolled hospitals and clinics. The light green are the counties where they have enrolled clinics only. And the yellow are counties where they have folks that are interested in exploring participating.
So I will comment real quickly. The name Jefferson is because of the mythical state of Jefferson, which some of us think shouldn't be mythical, but that's all right. Mm-hmm. And I wish I could take credit for this, but I really can't. Some local people got together, headed up by a gentleman named Richard Bottinger, and got this rolling, and just went out to all the hospitals, all the providers, and got everybody to agree to open the pipelines up and get this taken care of. And so I kind of assumed that's the way it was across the state, because it was so easy in my practice to get the information. Clearly, that's not the case, and it's nice to see. It's sometimes, you know, a region of the state will pioneer something that hopefully the rest of the state will pick up. The big population center, which is the Tri-County area, of course, hasn't gotten there yet, but we're hoping that we can give them a model that might work.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. It occurred to me, listening to your comments about one of the projects in the grant, about connecting behavioral health information, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't want to turn this into a gun thing, but that's exactly what I'm going to. But is there any way that that could be shared with whatever, I mean, so that they, when someone applies for a permit or something, and they could be, if there's not an active,
HIPAA violation.
You see what I'm saying, though?
There are huge legal barriers to that, and we need to get this going so that the vast majority of people who are in our healthcare system get good health care with sharing information, and that's a bridge too far right now. I'm just being honest about it, but boy, you.
No, but I understand that.
I understand the information. I get your point.
Because I'm thinking, it seems like all the events that get the coverage in the press about the gun stuff, seem to, many of them, if not all, have a mental health issue involved. So.
Mr. Chair. Representative Boone, Senator Bates and I both cringed when you said that because we get so burned by these HIPAA issues, health and privacy and information privacy law stuff, and we're, frankly, most of us in the health care world are a little terrified about the federal government's enforcement of that law because you can get pretty badly burned if you make an, even if you make an inadvertent minor goof. That being said, there is one really important exception to the HIPAA law and to confidentiality rules that I think perhaps we could do a better job of reminding healthcare providers of, which is what's commonly called the Tarasoff exception, which comes from a very sad case in California back in the 70s, where a psychiatrist didn't notify law enforcement that one of his patients had made it explicitly clear that he was going to kill his ex-girlfriend. And then proceeded to do so. And the family sued, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court made it crystal clear that it is completely legitimate for healthcare providers to violate patient confidentiality if they believe that there is imminent risk of harm to self or others. And at that point, it is justifiable. But it has to be imminent. Vague threats or the fact that someone has poorly controlled schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or anything else do not qualify for a Tarasoff exception. And so we just have to be very careful. And we are caught between a rock and a hard place on this one, and I think we all recognize it. But it's probably not a bad idea for us to think about some ways to remind healthcare providers statewide about the Tarasoff exception. We're all trained on it, but...
And we did pass, I think it was House Bill 2984-48 last year to clarify HIPAA exceptions.
Yeah.
And to
good
make
point.
Yeah. So there were several things that we did to clarify and give more protection to people who were actually sharing information as opposed to withholding.
Right. And so we just need to do a really good job of educating healthcare professionals, hospital systems, et cetera, on those exceptions and those clarifications that are available under Oregon statute. Because there are times when we should be sharing more information, and people get a little terrified. It's the legal equivalent of, it's the sort of non-disclosure equivalent of defensive medicine with too many lab tests.
We also, yesterday in our mandatory training, we heard regarding our own situation here to report even if you suspect, just to be safe, you know, in that sense. So, you know, that said, I know it's not HIPAA.
It's a difficult situation, calls for a lot of judges, part of the practitioners. Susan, anything else?
No, thank you so much.
Yes, you're right on time. I got you out early, but it was only 2 minutes. Sorry. So we are adjourned. Thanks, Susan.